Battlefield Earth, Part 2, by L. Ron Hubbard, continued. Cassette 12, Side 1. No reparations for Earth? Johnny felt like jumping up and protesting. If Sir Robert or McAdam had been here... A trillion credits fine, whispered Lord Voraz, is stiff. It will crash the whole Tallnep economy. Even if Earth were awarded city damages, Tallnep could never pay them after that huge fine. Be happy about it. You got rid of all the hostile forces. And got rid of all challenges to a clear title, thought Johnny sourly. Now they were wide open to the bank foreclosure with no real money to meet it. But Foul Japan was coming down on Johnny.
Your emissary was not here. This is highly irregular. It does not void or change these findings. But if he is not here to sign them, they will not be valid. Your war will go right on. So you better advise your government to get him here quick. These papers will be ready for signature tomorrow afternoon. Are you going to see he is here?
I'm not a representative, began Johnny.
You have influence, said Foul Japan. Use it. We want to finish up here and go home.
You better do as he says, whispered Lord Voraz.
Johnny looked up to see Dry's Glotten standing at the door. He'd come back. As Johnny walked out, Dry's asked Lord Voraz,
Is the Earth representative coming?
Voraz pointed to Johnny.
Will you get him here? Dry's Glotten asked Johnny.
Johnny said he'd try, and Dry's and Lord Voraz looked at each other and grinned. He was too disheartened about no reparations for Earth to give much thought to them. 3. A few feet from the door of the conference room, Johnny started to get mad. War. Any one of those lords in there, or their governments, merely had to say the word and their fleets pranced off to bash somebody's head in. And when they'd bashed it in, they could just sail off, tra-la, without a thought of what they'd done to people's homes and lives, and then maybe come back another day to bash some more. Johnny took a walk around the causeway of the bowl. It was a sunny noontime, and the mine entrance and exhaust fans made a gentle breeze as they changed the air. The little children lay in the rifle pits, shaded with bits and pieces of cloth. They followed him with their eyes. The dogs woofed and snuffled at him from the ends of their leashes, and somehow, recognizing him as a friend, wagged their tails. The older children, having fed the younger ones, were sitting cross-legged and eating from bowls. They grinned and nodded as he went by. Johnny thought, why shouldn't these children have a chance? Why couldn't they have a future that was happy and safe? War. What right did cold, impersonal nations have to murder and rampage, to smash and crush and gut their more helpless fellow beings? Call it national policy, call it necessities of state, call it what you will, it still amounted to an action of the insane. Cyclo. What right did Cyclo have striking this planet down? Couldn't they have bought what they wanted? Couldn't they have come in and said, we need metal? We will exchange this or that or technology for it? No, it suited them better to murder and steal it like a thief. He thought about the time before the visitors came when first they had been free from the oppressive tyrants. The people had been trying to get on with it, had been happy, had been working with a will. And then the visitors came, and with them the bank. Organization might be necessary, but it gave no one the right to create a government that was an inhuman, soulless beast. He thought of Brown Limper and his idiocies in the name of the state. Yet Brown Limper had been almost sensible compared to those lords in there. Johnny looked at the children, and he made up his mind. Whatever happened, there would be no more war, not anywhere. He had been so engrossed in his thoughts that Chief Chong Wan had to shake his arm to get his attention. The chief was jumping up and down and waving at Johnny to come on, and at last practically pushed him into the ops room. Tinny was beaming. A chatter of Polly was spraying out from around her headphones. She said something into her mic,
and turned to Johnny.
It's the Scot officer in charge of rescue in Russia, said Tinny. They spotted some green smoke coming from a ventilator in puffs. Somebody inside had gotten the armor off the ducts. They've got mine hoist gear going right this minute, hauling people out.
Minute by minute, the reports came in. Then Tinny turned to Johnny.
It's Colonel Ivan. It's for you. He says, tell Marshal Johnny the valiant Red Army is still at his command.
Johnny was about to reply. He was finding it hard to talk. But Tinny said,
here's another one for Johnny. He wants to hear your voice.
She pushed the headset at Johnny. Security or no security, the voice said, Johnny, it's Tom Smiley Townsend. Johnny couldn't talk. Johnny, the village people are all okay. Everybody is all right, Johnny. Johnny, are you there?
Thank God, Johnny forced himself to say. Tell them that for me, Tom. Tell them all, thank God.
And he sat down in a chair and wept. He had not realized how worried he had been about them. He had suppressed it with an iron will so that he could work. The reports were still coming in, and after a while he got busy. They wanted to know where to go, and he, in his turn, had the glad news for them of the departure of the enemy and the terms, and shouts and cheers began to leak through from the background of the communicator's voice there. They had 5 wounded pilots and a lot of burn cases, and they wanted help from Scotland. He learned the old underground hospital in Aberdeen had been set up, and he got the badly wounded ones flown through to it, and pried a nurse loose in Aberdeen to be flown back to Tashkent to care for the minor burns and injuries. He had gotten so busy with these problems that he had forgotten all about Sir Robert until Dries Glotten got Chong Wan to remind him of it. Johnny had been avoiding it a bit. They had not yet succeeded at Castle Rock, and he knew that trying to pry Sir Robert loose was going to take some doing. He had even wondered whether he couldn't get Lord Faljapan to put off the signing a day. Sir Robert was going to be a handful. Even so, he put the call out and got busy arranging for all prisoners to be put down at Balmoral Castle about 50 miles to the west of Aberdeen, easily found from the air because of 3 noticeable peaks nearby, because of a river, and because it itself was a prominent ruin. It was only about 50 miles from Aberdeen on a road that was in fair condition, but Thor said he could pick any up in a marine attack plane and get them to the hospital in Aberdeen if they needed it. Johnny gave him some precautions and then went out and got the Hawven emissary, who seemed to be the contact now with the orbiting fleet, and gave him a trace map so he could transmit it to the Hawven commander. They said they could do it this afternoon without waiting for the final signatures. Nobody knew how many prisoners there were, but they'd be flown down in different launch craft. Johnny left it up to them and to Thor in Scotland. Doing all that had given him a pretty distinct impression that things were very hectic around Edinburgh, and he was even less inclined to call Sir Robert. Once more, Dries Glotten got Chong Wan to push him. Good Lord, those small gray men were anxious to get Sir Robert here. He finally persuaded communicators up there in Scotland to track down Sir Robert, and when he finally got him on the radio, every misgiving he had had was fully justified.
Come down there,
Sir Robert had rapped back via communicators. And so far as it could be translated and relayed, he told Johnny off properly. Didn't Johnny know that there were 2,100 people in the various ancient shelters beneath the rock? If they were still alive, that heavy bombs had smashed in every possible entrance. They had gotten atmosphere hoses drilled in here and there, but who could talk through those? The rock cliff's sides had been pulverized and shattered so that every time they got adrift going in, they had landslides. Yes, Dwight was there. Yes, Dwight had gotten tunnel casings from Cornwall and tried to drive them in. Did Johnny think they were all standing around doing nothing? It was all right for Johnny to be sitting around with those la-di-da lords drinking tea. Go right on and drink tea, but let people get on with this. It took Johnny half an hour to impress on Sir Robert that without his signature,
the matter of the visitors wouldn't be ended. Finally, with considerable blasphemy that the communicators couldn't handle well in Polly, Sir Robert said he would pry a pilot loose and fly down. Johnny sat back, feeling exhausted. He didn't like to fight with Sir Robert, and he could understand his position completely. His Aunt Ellen was in those closed-off shelters, and Chrissy. It was all he could do to sit here handling things when he felt he should be up there digging with his bare hands if necessary. The small gray man looked very pleased when Chong Wan told him Sir Robert was coming. 4. Out of the night sky from the north, rushing far ahead of its sound, seen at first as just another star, a plane approached Kariba. The anti-aircraft gunner intercom sounded. The plane was friendly and requested permission to land. Johnny went to watch it set down. The door opened and somebody jumped out. The face was a white blur in the night. Johnny peered more closely. Bandages. Somebody with his face totally bandaged. A finger pointed at Johnny's beard.
The very thing.
It was Dunnell Dean. They swatted each other happily. Then Dunnell Dean pushed Johnny back into better light and looked at him.
The very thing. Somebody cut your beard half off. And mine's burned half off. Make an appointment for me with your barber.
Did you get shot down? Said Johnny, looking a little anxiously at the swath of bandages on his face.
No, laddie, don't be insulting, said Dunnell Dean. What Bulbard or Draken or Hockner could shoot down the ace of all aces? No, Johnny boy, it was helping fight fire. That's not too bad a burn, but you know Dr. Allen. Never happy unless he swaddled you up like an innocent babe.
How is it up there? Said Johnny.
Bad. We got the fire out, but that's all you can say for it. Dwight and Thor are trying to open tunnels, but the rock slides. There's lots of hope, but that's all I can give you. Say, did that small gray man come back here? Is that his ship over there?
Was he at Edinburgh?
Oh, that he was. Went all around bothering everybody, asking questions, got in everybody's way. And then he seemed to get what he was looking for, and went swooshing up to Aberdeen, almost got himself shot down. He was looking for the king, you know, chief of Clanfergus.
How is he, the chief? Said Johnny.
Well, he's a bleeder, you know, doesn't stop bleeding once he's cut. I'm always telling him to stay out of wars, they're unhealthy. Anyway, we found him outside and rushed him to the Aberdeen Hospital and they gave him transfusions. This small grey man tried to get in to see him and, of course, the gillies threw him out. But then Dr. Allen got cornered by him. Seems like this guy,
he indicated the ship where the lights were flashing,
has been collecting books and libraries all over the place. He pictographs them, and he got Dr. Allen to tell him what was wrong with the chief. And they looked it up in a lot of old man books, and Dr. Allen found there was a compound called vitamin K that made blood coagulate, and they synthesized some, and what do you know? The bleeding stopped. The chief's recovering. What is this small gray man? A doctor?
No, said Johnny. He's the sector branch manager of the Galactic Bank. I'll tell you more later. But he was up there making sure this planet had a government.
Well, that was a nice thing to do, anyway, said Dunnell Dean.
Johnny was glad for the chief, but he sure was beginning to feel surrounded by the bankers. He didn't tell Dunnell Dean they were about to foreclose on them. You see Storm along? Dunnell Dean shook his head.
Let's get Sir Robert. He's dead to the world in the plane.
And Sir Robert really was dead to the world. Singed and gray-faced where his skin wasn't blackened with soot, his hands torn, his clothes in burned rags, Sir Robert looked exactly what he was, an old man who had been going through hell for days without rest. They tried to lift and carry him between them, but the old war chief was a very heavy man, especially when dead weight. They got a mine cart and wheeled him into the hospital. Johnny got the nurse up, and she examined Sir Robert. He was not injured except for his hands. She gave him a shot of B-complex, and he never stirred at the punch of the needle. Mr. Tsung and his family were suddenly up and hovering around, and they ran off to get things organized. Shortly, they were giving Sir Robert a bath and trimming the burned areas in his beard and hair so they looked more even. They soon had him in a bed. He had never opened his eyes. Johnny went back to the hospital where he had left Donald Dean and found him sitting in a chair, sound asleep, while the nurse changed his face bandages. The burns were not disfiguring. His beard sure was tattered. Johnny stopped the nurse from putting on fresh bandages and called Mr. Tsung's daughter, who came in with her scissors and neatened the Scot by cutting his beard like Johnny's. Johnny had hoped Donald Dean could spell him in ops while he went to look for Stormalong. But Donald Dean was really in no condition to do anything but sleep. Johnny turned him over to the Tsung family, and they gave him a bath and put him to bed. It must be hell in Edinburgh. Johnny got on the radio to Russia. They had had several thousand people stuffed into that old base. Smoke or no smoke, some of them must be functional. There were 250 Chinese there from North China. There were the Siberians and the Sherpas. Tinny got some of her own messages in. The rest of the monks and the Buddhist library, the Chinese library and such things were safe. She had to run out and tell Chang Wan and Mr. Tsung. Late at night, it might be, in both Tashkent and Edinburgh, but Johnny started shuffling people. The most vital question now was, where was Stormalong? Where was McAdam? The only thing they ever got out of Luxembourg was a girl saying something that sounded like, "Je ne comprends pas." And that sure didn't spell Stormalong or the Scot banker. Was he going to have to handle this foreclosure thing with no help? 5. The treaty signing, Johnny was told, would be that afternoon. They came, Lord Dom and Dries Glotten, to the ops room. Dries seemed extraordinarily pleased. "I hear," he said, "that the Earth representative arrived last night. Be sure he is at the signing." Johnny glanced at his watch. It was mid-morning. He went to the room where they had put both the old war chief and Donald Dean. Donald Dean was up and dressed and seemed bright enough for all his bandaged face. Sir Robert was just groggily opening his eyes, so Johnny took Donald Dean back to ops. "I want you to take over this post," said Johnny. "I'll stay for the signing, but right after that I'm getting out of here to search for Stormalong." He spent some time genning Donald Dean in, and then went back to Sir Robert. The old Scot was as grumpy as a bear. He was sitting on the edge of the bed with nothing much to cover his bony limbs and eating something Chief Chang Wan had brought him. "Treaty signing," he grumped between bites. "Waste of time. They'll never keep any treaties. This is a beautiful planet here, and they want it. I belong right up in Edinburgh, helping dig those poor people out. Oh, you were right, McTyler. They all should have been at Cornwall." Johnny let him finish his food, and then, while he was having some tea, went out and got an atmosphere projector. And although Sir Robert spent much of his time muttering and railing about being absent from Scotland, Johnny briefed him carefully on events and what they could possibly do. When he had finished, he stood back. "I'm no diplomat," said Sir Robert. "I prove that. And I'm no lawyer, and I'm no banker. 'Tis a thin chance, but I'll do what you say." That was all Johnny wanted. In mid-afternoon, they went to the conference room. Sir Robert was in his regimentals, Johnny in his helmet and black tunic. Nobody paid them much attention. The emissaries had drawn up the treaty Johnny had heard voted, and they had it on a big scroll, laid out in such a way that each emissary could walk up to the table where it lay, sign it, affix his seals, get the signature and pattern or print attested by the bank, and then go back to his seat. It was a sort of parade. Dries Glotten and Foul Japan were the only ones who stood at the table. Sir Robert sat and fumed about wasting time, but he did so only in a very low voice and only to Johnny. They signed and signed. It took them almost an hour. Earth was the last signature, and Sir Robert went up and put down his name, got a match and melted some wax, and then smashed his big seal ring onto it. Dries drew a bank trace around it and held it up.
"I hereby certify," said Dries, "that the Galactic Bank has attested the authenticity of this Treaty of Kariba, Earth. It is complete. May I suggest that immediate copies of it be transmitted to all ships concerned?"
He spread the treaty out, pulled a small picto tracer from his breast pocket, and scanned it down the scroll. Johnny passed it to Dunaldine and Ops for transmission and copies for themselves and all delegates and the bank. The Lord of the Hovens stood up.
"I have received word that all prisoners were put down at the designated place and signed for by the Earth representative there."
Dries looked at Johnny. Word had come from Thor in mid-morning. There had been 7 pilots, 3 Russian soldiers, 2 Sherpas, and 1 Scot, 13 in all. They had been in fair condition, but since none of these invading ships had the kind of food terrestrials ate, they were suffering badly from starvation, and certainly would have died in months-long space travel. They had been rushed to Aberdeen for intravenous feeding and treatment of minor injuries. Thor had had a row with the Hovind officer in charge of the landing, for one of the pilots remembered another pilot he was sure the Tallnaps had picked up. After sending the first group off, Thor had stood by, and sure enough, the Tallnaps had another pilot, a German. It had taken 2 hours to get him set down. They swore that was all. Thor had then believed them. "Our officer attests we have the prisoners back," said Johnny. The emissaries who had ships in orbit then passed their orders to their respective commanders. There was a wait. Then Dunaldine came in to report that, according to sightings from Russia, the whole flotilla in orbit had flamed up, gotten into formation around the Tallnap vessels, and left. The phenomena of their getting very big and vanishing had been observed. Radio contact was lost. The whole group went outside, and Angus fired a spitting, naked, and chained slime to the slave market in Crete. The emissaries came back to the conference room. Footnote. There was a curious aftermath to this treaty. Lord Schleim arrived back in Tallnep, used the owners of the Crete newspaper, the leading Tallnep journal Midnight Fang, who were incensed at the loss of their ace reporter, Arsabager, to conduct a smear campaign on Captain Rogoditer Snowell, blaming him for the entire disaster, Schleim claiming it was Snowell's false testimony which had brought about Schleim's and Tallnep's disgrace. Rogoditer Snow was set upon in the streets of Crete by a mob which bit him to death. A relative of the slain officer, Adjutor Snow, in his turn blamed Lord Schleim for the attack and murder. He and a group of fleet officers waited until Lord Schleim next addressed the government, and then blew up Schleim and the entire assembled House of Plunder in an incident which became known as the Great Schleim Plot. Soon thereafter, its fleet gone and no longer able to engage in the slave trading which had formed the basis of its economy, Tallnep was unable to meet its indemnity payments. Its income tax department, always corrupt, fell behind in its bribe quotas to higher officials and, one by one, seized Tallnep citizens for tax delinquency, had their fangs drawn, sterilized them, and sold them into slavery. The Hovinds eventually bought the planet and completed the extermination, and the Tallneps became extinct. Excerpted from Galactic Bank Customer Service Summaries, Volume 4356-2789A. End of footnote. Sir Robert thought that was all. He was sitting in the front row, grumbling. Dries Glotton smiled. He walked over to Sir Robert, and he drew a thick paper from his pocket. "My lords," said Dries to the assemblage, "are witnesses to the fact that there is no further dispute over the ownership of Earth. The government of the planet is intact. The king is recovering. The Earth representative here is legally empowered to act for the government. The title to the planet is clear, he said triumphantly. Emissary of Earth, I hereby serve you with a notice of delinquency of payments. If, after a discussion, but in no case later than 1 week, this mortgage remains unhandled or unpaid, it will result in foreclosure on the planet and all its assets and peoples. He dropped the paper in Sir Robert's lap. Consider yourself legally served with due process. Sir Robert sat there, staring at the paper. Dry's glutton smiled a shark-like smile at Johnny. Thank you very much for getting him here and into the open so that he could legally be given this paper. In addition to being branch manager, I also usually act as my own collections department. He went over to a chair and picked up a foot-high stack of large booklets. He returned to the platform and addressed the assembled emissaries. Honored lords, said Dries, the primary business of this conference, to clear the title of Earth, is complete. However, I know each one of you has full authority to acquire territories for your state. There are other means than war. The lords shrugged. War was the surer method, said one. The mental health of the people depended upon war, said another. How was the state to demonstrate its power without war? Said Browl. The Galactic Bank would have a hard time surviving without making war loans, quipped Dom. Rulers only became famous when they prosecuted war, laughed another. They were all in a jovial mood. Johnny listened to all this with a kind of horror. The impersonal cruelty of large government was brought home to him. Get on with it, Your Excellency, chuckled Faljapan. We all know what you're going to say. Dry smiled and began to hand out the booklets. Here are some brochures I made up while waiting for a clear title. You will find data like mass, surface area, weather, number of seas, heights of mountains, and you will also find some scenic views. It is a very pretty planet, really. It would support several billion people, providing they could breathe air. But most of you have air-breathing colonies that even now are overcrowded. He finished handing the brochures about, and the lords began to scan through the colored pictures. You have collateral and credit, and many of you cash. It would take a minimum mercenary force to occupy it, for, as you know, its defenses are quite antiquated, and it has minimum personnel to resist an invasion. Conveyance of title would include all people and assets. Therefore, should you care to linger, there will be an auction of this planet as a bank foreclosure and repossession in the next 7 days, unless suitable arrangements for payments of its debts are made. Which hardly seems likely, for they are without other adequate cash or collateral or credit. Thank you, my lords. They were all chattering to one another and examining the brochure and seemed quite in a holiday mood. It was obvious they would stay around, even those from distant universes. Johnny said to Dry's glutton, So it was all just a question of money. Dry's smiled. We have not the slightest feeling of hostility toward you. Banking is banking and business is business. One must pay one's obligations. Any child knows that. The banker turned to Sir Robert. Arrange a meeting for negotiations as soon as possible, will you? Then we can get this thing over with and done. Sir Robert and Johnny walked out. 6. There was a lot of activity in the bowl. Chief Chong Wan's tribe of Chinese had, for the most part, been replaced in Edinburgh by the North Chinese Johnny had sent there from Russia. The returning people were smudged and singed. Some were in a state of obvious exhaustion that not even rest on the flight from Edinburgh had eased. They rushed gladly to their children, scooping them up, embracing them, throwing questions to the older children. The dogs were straining at their leashes and barking joyously. It was a scene of glad reunion. Johnny was glad he had gotten them replaced on the rescue team. They had worked without ceasing and soon would have been unable to carry on. Yet they had worked until they nearly dropped. watching fathers in happy chattering exchange with their youngsters, watching mothers anxiously verifying whether this or that had been done properly, as to feeding and naps, Johnny thought of those disdainful and arrogant lords and the soulless haughtiness of government. What did they care what happened to people like these? Yes, such governments might go through gestures of justice and perhaps even social work, but they remained cold, hard forces that could disrupt and shatter lives and people without conscience, without a second thought. Chief Chang Wan was getting them organized. He told Johnny as he rushed by that he was moving them all to the old mine site dome that had been cleaned up. It had rooms underground, and the armor cable was working there now. Well, Johnny was free of the signing conference. Dunnell Dean was available to take over. In ops, he asked Dunnell Dean, "Any news from Edinburgh come in with this tribe?" Dunnell Dean shook his head. Johnny grabbed an air mask and flight jacket. "Then I'm off to find Stormalong." He got no further than the exit to the bowl. He collided head-on with Stormalong himself.
"Where have you been?" cried Johnny. "I have called and called and called."
Stormalong pushed him into a bunker where they could not be overheard.
"I have been fighting and flying my goggles off for days."
He looked it. He was gaunt and hollow of eye. His white scarf was dirty, his jacket stained with sweat and grease. He even had a gun burn in his shoulder.
"You're hurt," said Johnny. "No, no, it's nothing. A Drawkin officer wouldn't surrender. I had to chase him with a marine attack plane. Imagine it, him on foot running up the side of a mountain, Ben Lomond, and me having to stun him, not kill him, just stun him, mind you, with a blast cannon. And then when I landed and got out, he was just playing dead and he shot me, and I had to stun him again with a handgun. Oh, laddie, it has been a wild time."
"What have you been doing?" demanded Johnny, making no sense of it.
"Catching prisoners. They left marines and pilots scattered around the Singapore site, some wounded, some not. They didn't bother to pick up their wounded in Russia. Dunnell Dean must have shot down 30 enemy planes around Edinburgh, and pilots that ejected are scattered to the west and in the highlands. It takes some doing, let me tell you, to pick them up. They think they'll be tortured or sprinkled with virus or killed, and they don't surrender easily."
"All by yourself?"
"Except for half a dozen bank guards. And they're French, Johnny. They're not soldiers. They can maybe guard a vault or carry valuables. Stormalong, I had radios in all those places. You must have had your set on. People must have seen you."
None of it made any sense to Johnny.
"It's McAdam, Johnny. He wouldn't let me answer. And anybody we saw, he told them they mustn't put on the air they'd seen us. I told him you would be worried, but he said no, no. Radio silence utterly and absolutely. I am sorry, Johnny."
With careful patience, Johnny said, "Begin at the beginning. Did you deliver the copies of the talk I had with the small gray men?" Stormalong sank down on an ammunition box. He verified they were out of sight and hearing of everyone.
"I got there about dawn and went right to McAdam's bedroom. And when he heard I was from you, he put the whole thing on a projector. Then he called the German and grabbed 6 bank guards and a whole basket load of galactic banknotes, and he told a girl in his office not to give out any information at all, and we got airborne. He just plain kidnapped me. We've been to every battleground looking for officers. He had a list of nationalities, and he wanted several of each. Johnny, those French bank guards are no help. I had to do all the flying and fighting. But I did get some rest, every time we'd collect some officers. Did you know both he and the German speak excellent Cyclo? I was surprised they'd been studying so hard. They'd interrogate them, and I'd get a couple of hours of catnap. Then we'd load the prisoners aboard, all tied up. The bank guards could sit there with a gun on them. And off we'd go to another location."
"What was he asking them?"
"Oh, I don't know. He didn't use torture. Sometimes he handed out a fistful of galactic banknotes. They talked."
Johnny looked out the bunker entrance at the plane. There were the bank guards, all right. They were dressed in gray uniforms. But they weren't pushing prisoners. They were unloading boxes, and some Chinese were bringing up some mine carts and rushing loads into the bowl.
I don't see any prisoners, said Johnny.
Oh, well, said Stormalong, we came back to Luxembourg and picked up some boxes, and he got a couple more bank guards, Germans this time, and we flew down to the Victoria mine site. I got a pretty good rest there because he spent so much time talking to the captives we already had there. Then we dumped out prisoners and came on, and here we are. And that's the whole thing. It was a long way from the whole thing, Johnny thought. He told Stormalong to go get some food and rest, and went out to find the banker. McAdam, short and stocky, his black beard flecked with gray, was pointing this way and that and rushing people along. He stopped abruptly when he saw Johnny and shook his hand vigorously. Then he turned and beckoned another man to come over.
I don't believe you ever met Baron von Roth, said McAdam, the other member of the Earth Planetary Bank.
The German was a huge man, as tall as Johnny and heavier. He was bluff and hearty, red of face.
Ach, but I am pleased, he bellowed and promptly gave Johnny a huge hug.
McAdam had vanished into the bowl, and the German picked up a heavy box and rushed after him. Johnny knew something of the German. Although he had made a fortune in dairy and other foodstuffs, he was descended from a family that was supposed to have controlled European banking for centuries before the Cyclo invasion. He looked like a very tough, capable man. The last of the baggage from the Marine attack plane was being wheeled into the entrance. Johnny couldn't figure out what they were up to. Inside, a crew of Chinese and some bank guards under the direction of Chang Wan were hanging huge mine tarpaulins all around the pagoda eaves to completely hide the firing platform itself. Some more Chinese were stringing mine cables and hanging tarps on them to make a covered passage from a bunker to the console. They were totally hiding the platform and all operation of it. McAdam was talking with Angus, and although they smiled at him when Johnny came up, McAdam was very rushed, and he said, "Later, later." All the baggage had vanished into the covered bunker. The Chinese children and dogs were all gone. Some Chinese were cleaning the bowl up. Some emissaries wandered out and watched what was happening with the tarpaulins, and then, showing little curiosity, wandered off, showing each other bits and points in the brochure. Donald Dean was on the job in the ops room and told Johnny that he'd talked Stormalong into getting his beard trimmed like Sir Francis Drake. No, nothing new from Edinburgh, except that the North Chinese now working there were doing fine. Did Johnny know they were much bigger men? Oh, yes, and Kerr and two bank guards were holding blast rifles on 50 new prisoners at Victoria. Johnny glanced up at the sky. If worse came to worst, he had his own way to handle this. A way which might make a fatal future, but which might have to be done. He went to his room to get into less spectacular clothes. They had a few short days, but days had a habit of passing awfully fast when you needed them. The final confrontation, the last battle, was all too near. 7. The fateful moment of the bank meeting arrived. 5 days had passed. Johnny sat alone in the small meeting room that had been prepared and waited for the others to arrive. There was not the slightest doubt in his mind that this was going to be a battle bigger than he had ever fought before. Being Johnny, he had been unwilling to simply sit idly by while McAdam and Baron von Roth prepared. They had been busy enough. For 5 days and nights, the hum of the teleportation rig had resounded through the bowl. Things had come and things had gone on the platform behind the tarpaulin. But they did no talking, lest they be overheard, and the only words that sounded were, "Motors off! No planes approaching! Stand by!" and "Fire!" Whenever anyone, especially emissaries or the small gray men, had come near the tarpaulins or the curtained corridor to a bunker, stern bank guards had pushed them back peremptorily. All Johnny got from McAdam was, "Later, later." Not even Angus was talking. He had gotten an estimate that it would be several days. Mr. Tsung had told Johnny that the negotiations of finance and banking were very specialized things. He had added one phrase that had stuck in Johnny's mind.
The power of money and gold over the souls of men passes all wondering.
The pre-dawn sky of the day after McAdam's arrival had found Johnny in the air. He had heard of a university outside the ruins of an old city named Salisbury, about 175 miles southeast of Kariba. He had tried to get Sir Robert to come along, but the old Scot was hanging on to the radio in the ops room, doing what he could for Edinburgh. Instead, Johnny had taken a couple of Chinese soldiers to shoo off the lions and elephants when they threatened to interrupt his studies. The university was a ruin, but the library could be sorted out amid the dust and debris, the roof and walls having stood. Camped out in the wreckage, Johnny had pried congealed packs of catalog cards apart and had pretty well found what he was looking for. It had been a well-endowed library once. It included lots of economics texts, probably because the relatively new nation had had a dreadful economic struggle of it. The texts were in English, and they covered the history of economics and banking pretty well. Mr. Tsung had been absolutely right. It was a highly specialized subject. And when one went wrong, like some nut named Keynes they had all become mad at, it really messed things up. What Johnny got out of it was that the state was for people. He had suspected that was the way it should be. And individuals worked and made things and exchanged them for other things. And it was easier to do it with money. But money itself could be manipulated. The Chinkos had been great and patient teachers, and Johnny knew how to study. And with a mind like his, he got things as quickly as a traveling shot. 4 of those 5 days had been spent ears deep in books, nose full of dust, with Chinese guards warning off black mamba snakes and African buffalo. Sitting there in the meeting room waiting for the others, he had the satisfaction of knowing that, while he was no expert, he would at least have a grip on what this battle was all about. Sir Robert came in, grumbling and cross, and took a seat over to the side with Johnny. Even though the small gray men had indicated it was between Sir Robert and them, the War Chief of Scotland knew that claymores and Lochaber axes weren't going to win this one, and as far as he was concerned, it was all up to the experts. Basically, he was very concerned about Edinburgh. They had gotten food and water through into the various shelters with thin hoses, but rock was still crumbling in on their tunnel efforts. They had been driving in huge, heavy pipe casings for days now, and the only hope was that they were not crumbling this time. Dries Glotton and Lord Voraz came in. A table for 4 had been set in the middle of the room, and they took 2 of the places on one side of it. They were very neatly dressed in gray suits. They had their arms full of papers and attaché cases, and they put them down. They looked exactly like hungry sharks. Neither Johnny nor Sir Robert had acknowledged their arrival.
"You don't seem very pleased this morning," said Lord Voraz.
"We be men of the sword," said Sir Robert. "We have small truck with the money changers of the temple."
Sir Robert's sudden use of English caused both small gray men to turn on their vocoders.
"I noticed," said Dries Glotton, "when I came in, that there were 50 soldiers in white tunics and red pants all around in the rifle pits in the bowl."
"An honor guard," said Sir Robert.
"They had an assortment of weapons," said Dries, "and one huge fellow certainly looked more like a brigand than an officer in charge of an honor guard."
"I wouldn't let Colonel Ivan hear you say that," said Sir Robert.
"Do you realize," said Dries Glotton, "that if you killed the emissaries and us, you would become an outlaw nation? They know where we are. You would have 12 fleets in here smashing you to bits."
"Better to fight fleets than be all cut up with bits of paper," said Sir Robert, gesturing at their piles of it. "There's no threat in the Russians if you tell the truth and behave."
Battlefield Earth, Part 2 by L. Ron Hubbard, continued. Cassette 12, Side 2.
There's no threat in the Russians if you tell the truth and behave. We ken this be a battle o' wits and skullduggery, but it's a battle all the same, and a bloody one.
Lord Voraz turned to Johnny.
Why do you regard us in so hostile a fashion, Sir Lord Johnny? I assure you we have only the friendliest feelings for you personally. We admire you greatly. You must believe that.
He seemed, and probably was, sincere.
But banking is banking, said Johnny, and business is business. Is that it?
Of course, said Lord Voraz. However, personal regard sometimes enters in, and in your case it most certainly does. I tried several times in the last few days to find you. It is unfortunate that we could not have had our talk before this meeting here. We are actually your personal friends.
In what way? Asked Johnny coolly.
A grizzly bear or an elephant would have backed off when Johnny sounded like that, but not Lord Voraz.
Do you realize that when a planet is sold, all its people and all its technology are sold with it? Didn't you read the brochure? You and your immediate associates are exempted in the sale, and so is anything you may have developed.
How generous, said Johnny with cold sarcasm.
Since we had no chance to talk and the others seemed to be late, said Lord Voraz, I can tell you now. We have worked out an offer. We will create a technical department in the Galactic Bank and make you the head of it. We will build a fine factory in Snouch, that's the capital of the system, you know, provide you with everything you need, and give you a lifetime contract. If the figure I already offered seems too low, we can negotiate it. You would not lack for money.
And money is everything, said Johnny bitingly.
Both bankers were shocked at his tone.
But it is, cried Lord Voraz. Everything has a price. Anything can be bought.
Things like decency and loyalty can't be, said Johnny.
Young man, said Lord Voraz, sternly, you are very talented and have many other fine qualities, I am sure. But there have been some radical omissions in your upbringing.
I would not talk to him like that, warned Sir Robert.
Oh, I'm sorry, said Lord Voraz. Forgive me. In my effort to help, I permitted myself to be carried away.
That's better, growled Sir Robert, and loosened his grip on his claymore.
You see, said Lord Voraz, a scientist is supposed to be hired by a company. What he develops belongs to the company. It's quite disastrous for a scientist to try to go it alone and manage his own developments and affairs. All companies and all banks and certainly all governments agree on this totally. A scientist is supposed to quietly draw his salary, turn over his patents to the company, and go on working. It's all been arranged that way. Why, if he tried to do anything any other way, he'd spend all his life in law courts. That is how it has been carefully arranged.
So the shoes a cobbler makes belong to him, said Johnny, but the developments of a scientist belong to the company or the state.
I see. Very plain.
Lord Voraz overlooked the sarcasm, or didn't hear it.
I am so glad you understand. Money is everything, and all things and talent are for sale. And that's the heart and soul of banking, the very cornerstone of business, a first principle.
I thought making a profit was, said Johnny.
Oh, that too, said Lord Voraz, so long as it is an honest profit. But believe me, the heart and soul...
I'm so glad to know, said Johnny, that banking and business have a heart and soul. I hadn't been able to detect one thus far.
Oh, dear, said Lord Voraz, you are being sarcastic.
Anything that destroys decent people has no heart and soul, said Johnny. And by that I include banking, business, and government. These concerns can only exist if they are for people, if they serve the wants and needs of the ordinary being. Lord Voraz looked at him searchingly. He thought for a bit. There was something in what Sir Lord Johnny was saying. He gave it up. He was a banker.
Indeed, said Lord Voraz. You are a peculiar young man. Perhaps when you get old enough to understand the ways of the world. Sir Robert's tensing was halted by the arrival of MacAdam and Baron Von Roth. Who's a peculiar young man? Said Baron Von Roth. Johnny? Indeed he is. Thank God. I see you two were early, he shot at Dries and Lord Voraz. Never saw anybody so anxious to collect their pound of flesh. Shall we begin?
Chapter 30 1 Andrew MacAdam and Baron Von Roth put down piles of papers and attaché cases on the floor on their side of the table, briefly shook hands with Dries Glotten and Lord Voraz, and sat down. Johnny blinked. MacAdam and the Baron were wearing gray suits. They were expensive tweed, and the individual fibers sparkled. But they were gray suits. The four of them sat there at the table for a bit, just looking across it at one another. Johnny was reminded of some gray wolves he had seen once, prowling back and forth, eyes alert, teeth ready, sizing each other up before they plunged into a snarling, slashing fight to the death. And it was a fight to the death, for if MacAdam and the Baron lost, that was the end of the people of this planet and all they held dear. He didn't have the least idea what MacAdam and the Baron had been doing, and it was with a sinking feeling that he heard MacAdam fire the first shot of the battle.
Are you sure, said MacAdam, that you gentlemen couldn't give us a little more time? Say, another month.
Dries showed his double row of teeth as his lips curled back.
Impossible. You have waited until the last moment. There can be no extension.
Times are very bad, said the Baron. There are economic upsets everywhere.
We know that, said Lord Voraz. It cannot be used as an excuse. If you were unable to pay your just debts and settle your obligations, you could have said so days ago and spared us this wait. I can't imagine what you were doing.
I was interrogating abandoned crew members of the departed ships, said MacAdam. It was a bit difficult to find an officer of each race that attacked this planet.
And they told you there were economic upsets, said Dries. You might as well sign this quit claim to the planet now and get it over with.
He pushed a form at Sir Robert, who didn't get a chance to take it. MacAdam pushed the form back to the table and let it drop.
I found that these crewmen did not want to go home. They had been conscripted, actually press-ganged into their services. Some felt that on return they might have to take part in revolutions or civil wars, and did not want to fire on their own people. Some felt that if they went home, they would just be discharged and have to join the mobs of unemployed that were starving and sometimes rioting in the streets of many capitals.
This is nothing new, said Lord Voraz. All this past year there has been unrest. That's why these emissaries here are planning wars of foreign conquest, to take the people's minds off all this. You could have asked me. I would have told you.
This changes nothing, said Dries. I advise you to surrender the planet tamely, for any of these emissaries would like nothing better than to buy this planet and mount a military expedition to wrest it from you. The ships that were up there were nothing compared to what could be sent against you. So if you will just...
The Baron fixed him with a bayonet stare. He said,
Having collected all the data available locally, we went to see for ourselves.
Johnny came alert.
Ah, so that's what all the firing was about.
This pair had been traveling all over the place. He'd noticed faint air mask marks on their jaws. Had they been doing something else than just traveling?
There is economic chaos, said the Baron. When Intergalactic Mining Company ceased to deliver metals, the scarcity caused their prices to soar. Factories are closed. People are out of work and rioting. To distract them, the governments are planning wars that are not popular. To get metals to build weapons, they are even commandeering people's cars and the pots and pans of housewives.
Dries shrugged.
This is not news. and it is totally off the subject of your unpaid balance. Does the Earth emissary sign this, or do we resort... He let the threat hang. The air seemed charged with electricity for a moment. The Baron's pale gray eyes bored into Dry's glotten.
You are in severe trouble, Your Excellency.
The branch manager shrugged. Internal concerns of the bank have no bearing on your paying up as you are obligated to do. Baron von Roth turned to Sir Robert.
His Excellency here committed his sector branch bank to some very unwise personal loans to the high executives on the cycloplanets Tortat and Turn in the Batafor system, and some even bigger personal loans to the cycloregent governors of 16 cyclo-owned planets in 4 nearby star systems. Those loans were secured by holdings in real estate on cyclo itself.
How did you find that out? Snapped Dries. It is confidential bank information.
A disgruntled employee you sacked, said the Baron. The real estate on cyclo went up in smoke, and the debtors are dead. An unwise bank risk. Cyclos were renowned for bad faith.
The depositors could bring pressure on the bank, said Voraz, defending his branch manager. But that does not change your loan.
Indeed, they could bring pressure, said the Baron. The basic profit income of the Galactic Bank came from handling fund transfers for cycloplanets, not from loans, but from the high percent charged by the bank for handling their funds. And with those Regency planet transfers shut off, Your Excellency, your Regency banks had to dismiss their staffs and close their doors. The senior branch bank in Baylor, your own personal office, fired nearly everyone. So that, Sir Robert, continued the Baron, is why you are being pressured. Dries figured the only route he had out of going bankrupt was to repossess Earth. It's the only planet in any universe that Intergalactic Mining Company owed any money on. He thought if he could auction this planet off, if only for a little cash, he could prevent total insolvency.
Pointing to the mud on someone's fins, said Dries, does not improve your own swimming. You had better sign over, or you yourself will drown.
This rehearsal of the last year's troubles was making him edgy.
Pay up, and pay up now.
He picked up the form and rattled it in front of Sir Robert. It crackled like a machine gun. McAdam reached over and pushed Dries's arm gently back down to the table.
We'll come back to that later.
The small gray man trembled. He could never remember being so upset before. It had been a very terrible year. What were these fellows up to? If they didn't have the money, why were they delaying? He sat back. Never mind. The end would be the same. Let them ramble.
Now, let's take up the main bank in the Gradides, said the Baron. The events there, right to Universe One. The capital city, Snouch, was damaged by the transshipment recoil, and so were the capitals of the other two Selachi planets. The whole top floors of the bank buildings were very badly damaged.
They can be rebuilt, said Lord Voraz.
The blasts knocked down the huge Galactic Bank signs, the ones you can see from all over the cities in each capital, and they're still hanging there shattered. You can see what they said, but that's about all.
They can be hung up again, said Lord Voraz, smoothly.
But for a whole year, the Baron bored in like a mind drill, you haven't done it. Now, all three Selachi planets depended upon banking. Those banks affected millions and millions of people. Then you lost teleportation. You were thereafter unable to reach the other 15 universes, space travel or no space travel. You have millions of Selachis stranded in branch banks all over those universes, banks as broke as His Excellency's, that you can't bring home. Families and relatives don't think they'll ever see their fathers or brothers or sons again.
There are mobs rioting outside your bank doors, rioting very loudly and howling for blood.
Lord Voraz shrugged. There are strong bank guards.
And how will you pay them? Said the Baron. Your bank income did not really come from loans, but from Cyclo fund transfers. The instant Cyclo and intergalactic mining were blown up, there was no further fund flow. You started to go broke, and you began to lay off employees. You know from Dryce here that many of your branch banks have had to close their doors. We have gone through economic difficulties before, said Lord Voraz. The Baron leaned closer to him. But not as bad as this one, Lord Voraz. The Cyclos were hated bitterly by peoples everywhere. When your Lord Lunga, whose face you carry on your bills, made a deal with the Cyclos a couple of 100,000 years ago to handle all their finances, he refused to let any Cyclo sit on the bank's board of directors. It would have hurt the bank's reputation, said Lord Voraz. A sensible move. People would have claimed it was a Cyclo bank.
Ah, yes, said the Baron.
But the Cyclos then insisted that forever thereafter the bank's reserves would be kept in vaults on Cyclo. They are gone?
Lord Voraz dropped his heavy eyelids for a moment. He passed his hand across his face. Then he rallied.
It is true. This still does not alter the fact that you are a debtor.
It certainly does, said the Baron. You are insolvent. And if you don't find assets to back you fast, you will go under.
All right, said Lord Voraz. But this just proves the fact that we must repossess this planet.
This one planet won't save you, said McAdam.
Why, said the Baron smoothly, don't you just grab some old cyclo-mining planets or regency planets? There are over 200,000 of them lying about.
Oh, here now, said Lord Voraz, horrified.
It is quite one thing to run down our credit and expose our troubles, but it is an entirely different thing to suggest the bank would ever engage upon piratical seizures of things to which it has no title.
Goodness, said Dryce, shocked. Those planets were all properly paid for. You simply can't engage in theft.
Their titles would be in dispute, said Lord Voraz. It would open up the bank to wars, and the bank is not a military organization. Anybody who touched those planets would wind up in court. No title to them. I must say you know very little about intergalactic law governing nations.
Oh, said McAdam. I think we do. Have you ever read the original Cyclo-Imperial Royal Charter of the Intergalactic Mining Company?
Exhaustively, said Lord Voraz. You can't do business with a company that doesn't file its charter. It was granted 302,961 years ago by King Dith of Cyclo. Why, there's a copy of it, or was, on the wall of every intergalactic mining central compound, required by law. I have read...
The Baron threw a copy of it on the table.
You should read the fine print.
He turned the copy around so Voraz could read it, though Voraz didn't bother to, knowing it almost by heart.
Note this clause here, said the Baron. Number 109. In the absence of a director or directors, the head of a planet owned by the said intergalactic mining company shall have the power to make resolutions, and his resolutions shall be binding.
Lord Voraz shrugged.
Of course. They had only one additional planet then, and the head of it was a royal prince. The directors at that time couldn't be bothered with business. I don't see...
But it is a valid clause, said the Baron.
Right, right, said Voraz. But you are just delaying...
Now, take this next clause, said the Baron. Number 110. In time of emergency and or threat to the company, and especially at a time of disaster, the head of a planet may dispose of company property. Note that it is not further limited nor qualified.
Why should it be? Demanded Voraz. It was the same royal prince. He wouldn't take the job away from home otherwise.
He was afraid of communication cutoffs or palace revolutions. He could have been left out there holding a claw full of company bills. It was Prince Sko.
But you agree, said the Baron, that these are valid clauses.
When do I get to repossess this planet? Said Dries wearily. Nothing in that charter will permit you to wriggle out of paying 40 trillion credits.
Lord Voraz corrected him. 40,960,217,605,216 galactic credits.
So there's nothing inaccurate in this royal charter, persisted the Baron.
Of course not, said Lord Voraz.
Theron von Roth and Andrew McAdam looked at each other and laughed, startling the other two. McAdam reached down into the papers beside his chair and drew up a thick pack of documents.
This was fully signed and witnessed 11 months after the destruction of the planet Cyclo.
He threw down the stack, and it landed like a cannon shot. It was all embossed with seals and glaring with huge official red ribbons and scarlet and gold discs. It was the Turl contract. It sold in full the entirety of Intergalactic Mining Company, all its equipment, assets, planets, and accounts. McAdam plopped another document on top of it. Here is the attest by the last planet head of the company that this is a true and valid contract, and it adds his total conveyance of the company. It was signed just a few days ago. Another paper was slapped down on top. And here is the receipt, and it says paid in full. Dries and Lord Voraz stared, open-mouthed. They had never been that startled before in their whole eventful lives. Seconds went by. Then, as one, they seized upon the pile and began to go through it. They read it. They looked for holes in it. Finally, Lord Voraz said in awe,
"It's valid, all right. I even see that it was signed by the legal government of this planet to the Earth Planetary Bank in payment for loans. Quite regular. Stand up in any court."
But Dries shook his head. "To be legal, and for it to be of any use to you in preventing the repossession, it would have to be recorded and put on file in the Hall of Legality on Snouch."
"Oh, but it is, said the Baron sweetly.
And he drew the file copy of the Hall of Legality form from his pocket and threw it down.
"Fully recorded just 3 days ago. In fact, it was the first thing I did when I got through the mobs."
Dries had gotten over his shock.
"It may give you planets and equipment. It might even give you collateral to borrow money on. However, the bank would take time to make the loan, and we wouldn't lend on top of an unpaid loan. The document simply proves that now you really owe the debt. I will have to demand instant cash."
"We'll come back to that," said the Baron. "Lord Voraz, how much would you say the Galactic Bank was worth? You know, assets and liabilities as per your last balance sheet."
Voraz bristled.
"We are under no obligation to show our bank balance sheets, particularly in the middle of collecting a debt from a debtor." "You do have a copy of one as of 2 weeks ago," said the Baron.
Voraz almost choked.
"Have you been rifling my hamper?" "Ach, Gott, no," said the Baron. "No reason to. I was told you had one."
"In any event, here is a current copy from your accounts office."
He pulled the immense, closely tabulated machine copy from his pile of papers and tossed it on the table.
"Counting all buildings, real estate owned, and accounts actually collectible, and subtracting bills owed, taxes yet to be paid, and all that, it seems to come to roughly 1 quadrillion credits."
"They had no right to give this out," said Voraz. "But I admit it is correct. Roughly 1 quadrillion.
"Providing we overlook the fact that you are about to go broke," said McAdam.
"The bank would liquidate for that," snapped Voraz.
"If you could get to the branches in other universes, which you can't," said McAdam.
The Baron waved a big hand airily. But we are in a generous mood, aren't we, Andrew? He smiled at Johnny. Aren't we? Johnny had his eyes riveted on the scene. It was like watching a bullfight. Our two friends here, said McAdam, indicating the small gray man, don't seem to be very generous. But we'll be big, said the Baron. Voraz, you desperately need somebody to back you. You need visible assets. Without them, you will fold, right? Voraz looked at him, glaring. Then he hung his head. True. McAdam said, so we're willing to bail you out. Right, Johnny? Johnny shrugged. Let them go ahead. There was going to be more to this fight. Voraz looked from McAdam to the Baron very watchfully. The Baron said, so, the Earth Planetary Bank is offering to buy 2/3 of the Galactic Bank. What? Cried Voraz. That's a controlling interest. You would control the whole vast empire of the Galactic Bank. He thought about it for a moment. And with what? The Baron smiled. We will buy it with 2/3 of a quadrillion credits worth of planets. He drew another sheet from the papers beside him. Pending further evaluation, a planet is worth a minimum of 60 trillion credits. Voraz said, to be honest, most are worth considerably more. The Baron said, you'd have assets, then. You could back your currency with reserves which you don't now have. The Cyclos never let you own planets, but you can now. We will turn over 11 planets that are worth 60 trillion credits for the ownership of 2/3 of the Galactic Bank, all its assets, debts, everything. Lord Voraz was wavering, but he had not said yes. McAdam leaned back easily. And we will put 199,989 planets and all company assets into a trust to be managed by the Galactic Bank. That gives you back your fund transfer profits. That lets you lease out mining rights. That surely saves your bank. Wait, said Lord Voraz. And they thought he was going to turn it down. I must be honest with you. You took your list of planets from the Intergalactic Coordinate Firing Table. It does not include the mine reserve planets. To push off all the planets it could on Intergalactic and to bleed the company, there was an imperial decree that Intergalactic Mining Company had to own 5 planets for every one it actively mined. There is a list of 1,000,000 additional planets recorded in the Hall of Legality with their coordinates, unexploited by Intergalactic. Also, I am afraid Dries never gave you the actual purchase contract for this planet. You keep speaking of it in the singular. It includes 9 other planets in this system and all moons, mentioned in passing because they are deemed worthless. There are also suns and nebulae and clusters. There is obviously an awful lot of intergalactic property you don't know about. Would you leave it up to us to ferret it out and include that in the bank-managed trust also? McAdam smiled. Seem all right to you, Baron. Find any flaws in that, Johnny? Johnny thought about it. There was another situation here they were evidently overlooking. But he saw nothing wrong with what the Earth Bank was doing. With a hand outstretched to Lord Voraz, McAdam said, we agree. Voraz had made his point. He started to reach for the hand, and then he drew back. Such a deal has to be ratified by a Galactic Bank board meeting. The Baron laughed. Good. Let's hold one. They can be convened anywhere in 16 universes, according to your charter. Wait, said Lord Voraz. There are 12 other board members, rich, influential Salachis, who are... scared to death, the Baron finished for him. The state of the bank and the riots made them believe they would lose all their personal property and fortunes if the bank went under. So they thought this was a great offer. Voraz gaped. But they can't hold a board meeting behind my back. Oh, they didn't, said the Baron.
They gave me all their proxies, and these delegate to me the right to place their votes. He reached down and threw another pack of documents on the table. There they are. Lord Voraz stared at them. He recognized the personal seals. They had even been filed at the Hall of Legality. So, as chairman, said the Baron, would you please convene a board meeting of the Galactic Bank at once and move that the Earth Planetary Bank buy 2/3 of the Galactic Bank? It will have to be a typed resolution, said Voraz. I do hereby convene the meeting. I even have my seals. But here's the resolution, said the Baron. All typed. I'm awfully glad you're convening the meeting, for it saves the trouble of going back to Snouch and getting you fired. Voraz laughed suddenly. You are a pair of hard rock eels. That was typed by my own secretary. That's her initial. Right, right, said the Baron. A charming girl. She was trying to save your and her jobs. Now, just sign there as chairman of the board and president. Wait, said Voraz, suddenly sober and worried. This is all very well, but there are 3 things that could ruin this whole deal and all of us. Dries interjected. The first is how do I get my money, cash, right now, for the mortgage here? Oh, that, said McAdam. He scooped up a huge sheet of paper which unfolded yards long. This is the intergalactic mining money transfer summary from your bank. It says that on day 92 of last year, there were certain intergalactic funds in process of transfer. They were given over to the bank for further relay, but the bank, of course, was thereafter unable to relay them. Payments for metals, salaries, they're all listed here. They are still in your bank. That's all intergalactic money. When we were in Snouch, we started an account for the Earth Planetary Bank. Let's see. The total of received and unrelayed funds from 200,000 planets for their past month was 209,438,971,438,643 credits. That's our money. Just subtract the mortgage from it, and it still leaves us about 168 trillion. McAdam rummaged around in his pile of papers. Here's our letter of authorization, and here is the receipt for you to sign, Dries. The small gray man was sitting there speechless. He was trying to realize he was solvent. He had not thought to recover more than 10 trillion in a forced sale. He sat up and grabbed a pen to sign the receipt. Lord Voraz stopped his hand. That's all very well, he said in a worried voice, but there are 2 other matters. He turned to Johnny. Can you forgive us for trying to treat you as a hired hand, Sir Lord Johnny? It is quite true that we cannot operate at all without transshipment rigs and consoles. We are cut off. We used to ship all bank business on the Cyclo rigs, using our own bank boxes. They charged us heavily, but to deliver a dispatch by spaceship can cost 50,000 credits and takes ages. Are you going to help us in this? That's all Johnny's, said McAdam. We at the bank don't own any part of it. Johnny, we can make you a loan at low interest and help you set up a manufacturing plant, a separate company that you own. How about it? 2. Johnny roused himself. He had been so intent upon finance that he had to consciously force himself to think about technical matters. It would be dangerous for Earth to have these consoles scattered through 16 universes, thousands, possibly hundreds of thousands of rigs in not always friendly or well-meaning hands run by other races. You could do a lot of things with a console. You could transport people, send dispatch boxes, ship ores, ship finished goods, send food. But you could also send bombs, as he himself had proven so fatally to the Cyclos, and as would have been the end of the Tallneps. He had not thought much about the problem. Many other things had been very urgent. Yes,
One console out there, much less 500,000, could be very dangerous to this planet. Give me a moment, he said. Mr. Tsung also had his uses for the moment and brought them some tea and a tray of bites between meals. It was nearing lunchtime. It also, as he had wisely noted, gave Johnny a needed moment to think. The Cyclos had had Cyclo operators. It didn't make much difference about the platform and rig. The same security measures could be used in the console itself, possibly even improved a bit. If he put a camera in the armored front of the case that would shoot a picture of every cargo... Aha! Metal analysis detectors. If they were built into the platform itself, they could analyze a cargo from all sides, above and below, and if that were connected to a circuit no one could get at in the console, and if that circuit had a metal tracer... Yes. If anything in a cargo matched forbidden traces like uranium or this ultimate bomb heavy element, the match of the circuit would separate a relay and the console would not fire. It was a trifle difficult to think with all these faces staring at him, waiting. He didn't have to be told. The fate of the banks depended upon it. And they hadn't mentioned a thing which could queer the whole deal. If he got with Allen and McKendrick and worked out disease, they said it had an aura. Anyway, there were disease viruses and bacterial traces, and he could work those in, whether disease had an aura or not. And if anything on the platform matched, they would trigger that relay, and the console wouldn't fire. He could rig it so if any of such items were put on platforms for Earth, he could tie in the coordinates of Earth so that the console would blow up. Then, if a sign were put on every console in plain view, like, "Any attempt to fire contraband cargo with this console will render it inoperative," no list of things, or else somebody might try to mask the trace. And if one added, "Any attempt to use this console in an act of war against Earth will cause it to explode," maybe even put out that the console could read evil intentions. Yes, he could build a foolproof console. And if the console seemed to be finally assembled in a place which was not known, by people who could not be found, he could make the construction areas very heavily defended. He would let only a very trusted, unbribable few do the final assembly. Start a school for extraterrestrial operators who knew only how to operate it. "I think I can do that," he told them. They all brightened up. Mr. Tsung took the tray away. "However," said Johnny, "the rigs will be a bit expensive. Unimportant. And I will not sell them, I will only lease them. Every 5 years a console will have to be exchanged for a new one. That would keep going an Earth that had no real income, and it would permit an inspection of views of cargoes that had been shipped. Some extraterrestrial firm will have to be brought in to make components and cases. Otherwise, it will take too long to build one."
"You can provide consoles?" asked Lord Voraz.
"He said he could," said the Baron. "If Johnny says he is going to do something, watch it. He will."
"All right," said Lord Voraz. "That brings us now to the most serious block of all."
He pointed in the direction of the big conference room.
"Those emissaries."
Voraz looked very gloomy.
"You are almost in the intergalactic banking business now, and will be if this resolution is signed. You had better understand that it is very tricky business handling such as those." "As you noted," he continued, "right now they have countries in riot. Their economies are in rags. But they are of such a nature that they will just sit there square in the middle of their prejudices, cling to their most arrogant opinions, and ignore everything else. Right this minute, I have better reason than you to know they are absolutely counting on war to save their economies and their states. They think that war powers and war hysteria will distract the people and secure their own positions. It is their only formula. This bank lived in the shadow of the powerful, even if hated, Cyclos. They are gone. You, and even the Gradites, are small planets. You have no great military force. To be blunt, those lords will not respect you. I read the ripples in the water with Lord Slime. He supposed the bank was no longer the power it had been. He thought he could violate a conference. He failed. But that kind of thinking couldn't have existed a mere 13 months ago. Others among those haughty lords will get the same ideas sooner or later. He pointed to the papers. You have here more than 1,200,000 habitable, useful worlds. It is very tasty bait for very big fish. Since these lords are bent on war to save their regimes, they will find a pretext not to respect the ownership of intergalactic Earth or the bank. They will raid these planets. They will quarrel over them. They will throw good sense and order to the winds and waves. The harder they are driven at home by economic chaos, the more they will seek a pretext to take outlaw actions. Johnny was listening to him. He had wondered for some time now when they would get around to this point. It was the key problem, and if it were left unhandled, all the doors they were trying to open would jam shut in their faces. Since I have been here, said Lord Voraz, not one of those elegant aristocrats has failed to draw me aside and try to discuss his nation's chances for a war loan. Of course, we seldom make war loans. All we do is issue the bonds for them and let them sell them to each other. There's no real money in war loans. With economics this shaky, the chances of their being paid back are poor. Wars are not as popular with the people who fight them as with the lords who run them and profit by them. Revolutions could occur, and revolutionaries are notorious as bad risks. So, before you commit yourselves to these risks, you should understand them. Johnny stood up. These small gray men had not signed anything yet. He had been afraid there would be a quibble. He picked up his helmet and silver wand. Sir Robert and I discussed this. We rehearsed it. It is risky, but I believe we have no choice. Do I have the temporary right, granted by all of you, to set bank policy for the next couple of hours? If it is successful, you will not be the losers. If I am not successful, you won't have lost anything.
You set bank policy? Gaped Lord Voraz. Let him do it, said the Baron. But he might commit us to some course of...
You just better say yes, Lord Voraz, McAdam said. That's Johnny Tyler there who's talking. Lord Voraz looked numbly from McAdam to the Baron.
I've not signed yet.
Nor have I, said Dryce.
The Baron reached over and made Voraz's head bob.
He said yes, Johnny. Go ahead.
But he might do something dangerous, Lord Voraz was trying to sputter. He is a very peculiar young man.
Johnny had already left with Sir Robert. A Sir Robert with a grim expression on his face. 3. The bowl of the firing platform area had been stripped of tarpaulins. A Russian trooper stood in each rifle pit, the noonday sun harsh on their white tunics and glittering weapons. A few emissaries lounged in the shade under the pagoda eaves. Johnny called for the host and ordered him to get the lords into the conference room. Stormalong, hearing the stir, popped out of the ops room with a dispatch in his hands, intending to rush over to where Sir Robert and Johnny stood. But the broad arm and bandaged hand of Colonel Ivan stopped him.
"Leave them alone," Colonel Ivan managed in English.
He had his orders. He stood and watched the emissaries going in the conference room door. He knew Johnny would be going in there in a moment, and he knew what Johnny was going to do. It made him a little nervous for Johnny, since he would have no direct protection in there. A casual glance had told him that many of these lords were secretly armed, for all their fine clothes and arrogant ways. When Johnny gave them the shock that was planned, they might react in violence. This book is continued on Cassette 13, Side 1.